This lecture is produced by Stone Kingdom Ministries of Asheville, North Carolina. Follow along in your Bible as James Brueggemann shares good news from God's Word. For a sample copy of our publication and a catalog of the resources available, write to Stone Kingdom Ministries, Post Office Box 5695, Asheville, North Carolina, zip code 28813. You may also visit us on the web at www.stonekingdom.org. Your regular financial support is what makes this ministry possible, and we are grateful to you for that. And now, here is Bible teacher James Brueggemann.
This is the second half of today's lecture, and the title is Absalom's Coup d'Etat and David's Surrender. We left off in 2 Samuel 15, verse 17. I'm going to reread that. It says, "And the king went forth, and all the people after him, and tarried in a place that was far off." Now that verse is a summary. They left Jerusalem and remained for a while in a place that was far off. And at this point, the sacred historian who penned 2 Samuel rewinds us to the scene now just as they're leaving Jerusalem. Verse 18. "And all his servants passed on beside him, and all the Kerethites, and all the Pelethites, and all the Gittites, 600 men which came after him from Gath, passed on before the king." If you recall, when David had to flee Saul, he began to attract to himself many men who were disaffected with Saul for one reason or another. They threw in their lot early with David, and eventually they numbered 600 men, and they were probably all Israelites, or almost all Israelites at that point. Remember also then that David and his men actually lived among the Philistines for 16 months. At that point then, they asked to be able to live in Ziklag, which was under Philistine control, but it was in the territory of South Judah. And probably at about that time, David began to incorporate into that group of 600 some warriors who had defected from three non-Israelite groups, the Kerethites, the Pelethites, and the Gittites. We identified them in that lecture many months ago, but let me refresh your memory. The Kerethites were either a branch of the Philistines, or at least they had been allies with them. Now their territory, let me pull out a wall map here real quickly to just show you. Here is the territory of Judah down here. All the rest of Israel's up here. Here's the Philistine territory. It doesn't even show us where Ziklag is, but it was right here about where the corner of the Philistine territory was, and the Kerethites and the Pelethites were also in that same area. You remember when the Amalekites attacked Ziklag, they also attacked the Kerethites, and then David and his men went in pursuit of the Amalekites. And so I'm suspecting that it was at that point that when they went to recover from the Amalekites their possessions and their women and such, that since the Kerethites had also been attacked, that some of them came aboard under David and joined his group of 600. Of course, there's no question who the Gittites were. They were men from Gath, which was one of the major cities of the Philistines. And remember, it was Goliath's hometown, wasn't it? But I believe that it is likely that as men from these non-Israelite groups joined the band of 600, even though the number might have varied above that or below that, they probably just kept the name, sort of like the 82nd Airborne or something like that. You know, the name stays the same, but the personnel change. So that when David became king some years after that, some of the original 600 Israelites settled down with their families in their tribal territories. You know, the war was over. And some of them perhaps remained in the 600, but a large number of the non-Israelites now comprised the 600. This was not unusual in the ancient world. Monarchs often had foreigners as their personal bodyguards, precisely because they would be less likely to be involved in an internal palace plot by members of the family. However, David's intel sources initially informed him that it appears that Absalom had the support of a far larger number of men than David's 600, and that's why David fled. Now, regardless of whether my interpretation of this is true or not, the fact remains that there was a band of Philistines and other non-Israelites who served as David's secret service. Next, David offers these strangers the opportunity to avoid sacrificing themselves for him. He speaks to the chief soldier of the contingent of the foreigners, who is a Philistine named Ittai, or Ittai, if you wish. Verse 19, "Then said the king to Ittai the Gittite, 'Wherefore goest thou also with us? Return to thy place and abide with the king, for thou art a stranger and also an exile. Whereas thou camest but yesterday,'" doesn't mean literally yesterday, "'should I this day make thee go up and down with us, seeing I go whither I may? Return thou and take back thy brethren. Mercy and truth be with thee.'" This is certainly a kind and noble offer on the part of David, isn't it? But look at Ittai's response, 21. "And Ittai answered the king, and said, 'As Yahweh liveth.'" I would say the man's a convert to the religion of Israel, wouldn't you? "As Yahweh liveth, and as my lord the king liveth, surely in what place my lord the king shall be, whether in death or life, even there also will thy servant be." The language kind of reminds us of Ruth, don't you think? Except that I have no doubt that Ruth was an Israelite, whereas I'm equally convinced that Ittai was not an Israelite. If this man and his band were Israelites, it's inconceivable to me that David would have offered if they were Israelites, I can't see how David would have offered them a free pass from the pending conflict. If they were Israelites, he would have expected them to stay by his side. But since they were Philistines, he said, "Look, if this isn't really your battle, you don't need to be involved in this internecine warfare. You can go home, go back to your king if you want." And of course they said, "No, we'll stay with you." Verse 22, "And David said to Ittai, 'Go and pass over.' And Ittai the Gittite passed over, and all his men and all the little ones that were with him." So they had their families with them as they evacuated Jerusalem. "And all the country wept with a loud voice, and all the people passed over. The king also himself passed over the brook Kidron," or Kidron, "and all the people passed over toward the way of the wilderness." It says the brook Kidron, but it seldom had water in it except after the heavy winter rains. And so most of the year it was simply a very deep and dry ravine. That word for brook could also have been translated valley, the valley of Kidron or Kidron. And it basically formed the eastern boundary of Jerusalem, separating it from the Mount of Olives. It says that once the people passed over it, they went towards the wilderness. That refers to the northern desert area of Judah, through which the road to Jericho ran, so that once they crossed the Kidron Valley, they were heading first towards the Mount of Olives, and then beyond that towards Jericho, and finally to the Jordan River at the northern tip of the Dead Sea. Hold up the map here once again and just trace that real quickly for you. There's Jerusalem. This is all Judah. So there was a lot of desert area here. Here's Jericho. So the Mount of Olives was right outside Jerusalem, and then the road to Jericho, and then they go on towards the Jordan River right there. That's where the action is taking place. So essentially, David stood just outside the city wall of Jerusalem and oversaw the evacuation of the city and let everyone pass over, that is, go down the valley and start climbing up the other side, which was towards the slope towards the Mount of Olives. And when they were all out, then David himself passed over the valley. Verse 24, "And lo, Zadok also and all the Levites were with him, bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God, and they set down the Ark of God, and Abiathar went up until all the people had done passing out of the city." There are two characters now in the story who are reintroduced here, Zadok and Abiathar. I say reintroduced because we have run across them before, but let's keep your marker here and turn back to 2 Samuel 8. 2 Samuel 8, which is where we first encountered them. It was in that chapter concerning the wars of David. And in verse 15 of 2 Samuel 8, it says, "And David reigned over all Israel, and David executed judgment and justice unto all his people. 16. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was over the host, and Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder, and Zadok, the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, were the priests, and Seraiah was the scribe. These men will figure prominently in the stories just ahead, so let me give you some of the scoop on them at this juncture. And I put this on the whiteboard up here, showing how Zadok was a descendant of Aaron through Eleazar. You remember, Aaron had four sons. Two of them offered strange fire. I can't remember their names right offhand. Does anybody remember? Anyhow, they died for offering the strange fire, those two, and Aaron was left with two sons, Ithamar and Eleazar. And as I said, Zadok was descended through the line of Eleazar, and his father was Ahitub. Abiathar was descended through the Ithamar line. And here we have Eli the priest. You remember him when Samuel was a boy and he went and apprenticed with Eli. Eli had two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, who turned out to be kind of rotten apples. Remember, they slept with the women at the door of the church. And so for that, there was a curse given, or a prophecy, which said that the priesthood would leave the line of Levi. And Eli's line comes down through Phinehas, down to Ahimelech, who was the father of Abiathar. And Ahimelech, you might recall from a few messages back, was the priest at Nob when David was fleeing Saul, and he went and asked him for the showbread. And then Doeg the Edomite came in, and they killed Ahimelech, the high priest, and 84 other priests at Nob, and massacred all the women and children, men, women, and children in the whole village. Well, that was his father. And if you recall at that point, Abiathar took the ephod, which contained the Urim and the Thummim, and he fled and joined, linked up with David while he was still in the wilderness. So that Abiathar was then, by rights, the high priest, his father having been murdered. Later on we find he has a son named Ahimelech, named after his grandpa, of course. But now we find here in the story of Absalom's rebellion, we find Zadok and Abiathar are both going to be mentioned as high priests. What happened here for the first time in history was we had two high priests. One, Abiathar, we've traced how he became a high priest. We'll talk about Zadok a little more in a minute.
And cousins to boot.
Both of the priestly line of Aaron. Now in 2 Samuel 8:17, why does it say that Zadok and Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, were the priests? Well, first of all, let's understand, as I pointed out a minute ago, there are two Ahimelechs. One is Abiathar's father, the other is his son. Nothing unusual about that. But why is the son, Ahimelech, mentioned in this instance and others instead of his father? And I believe it has to do with the same reason that in the 8 mentions of Zadok and Abiathar, mentioned when they're mentioned together in the account of Absalom's rebellion, we always find Zadok mentioned first. Wonder why? Well, for some unknown reason, David made Zadok the co-high priest and gave him precedence over Abiathar. Commentators speculate that perhaps Abiathar gave some evidence of a defect of character or had some other weakness which caused David to favor Zadok. And later, we will find that Abiathar deserts David and conspires with another of David's sons by the name of Adonijah in an attempt to obtain the throne, just as his older brother Absalom had tried. When Solomon became king, he could have put Abiathar to death for treason, but he did not, simply because he had been a high priest, and so he let him live. But when that happened, and Abiathar was removed by Solomon from the high priesthood, that left only Zadok and his descendants to be the high priestly line from then on. And that fulfilled that prophecy that was given to Eli way back hundreds of years before that, where a prophet came to Eli and said, because of you and your sons, the priesthood's going to be taken from you. Chronologically, I think that the first place we encounter Zadok is in 1 Chronicles 12. You can turn there or not. I'm just going to continue. This is where Saul had just died, and David went to Hebron and was made king. So in 1 Chronicles 12, beginning in verse 23, it says, "And these are the numbers of the bands that were armed or ready to war, and came to David to Hebron to turn the kingdom of Saul to him according to the word of Yahweh." Verse 24 says, "The children of Judah," and then it gives the thousands. And 25, "The children of Simeon," and the thousands. And "Of the children of Levi," in verse 26, 4,600. 27, "And Jehoiada was the leader of the Aaronites. With him were 3,700. Verse 28, "And Zadok, a young man mighty of valor, and of his father's house, 22 captains." So Zadok was not only of the Aaronic priestly line, he was a valiant soldier. And David, for some reason, at some point that we're not given in the scriptures, tapped him to be a co-high priest. Next, after David conquered Jerusalem from the Jebusites, you recall we studied how the ark was brought up to Jerusalem. First, the wrong way, right? On the ox cart, when my home state of Ohio and his brother Uzzah, or whatever, I don't know if he was a brother, Uzzah and Ohio were trying to steady the ark, and Uzzah touched the Ark of the Covenant and got zapped. I think he was electrocuted. And then David parked it in Obed-Edom's garage or his front yard or something for several months until he could figure out how to move this Ark of the Covenant correctly. And that is when he puts Zadok and Abiathar, the two co-high priests, in charge of bringing the Ark up to Jerusalem. And the next incident of Abiathar and Zadok is the current story, Absalom's attempted coup d'etat. Later on, when Abiathar sides with Adonijah against David and against Solomon, Zadok sides with Solomon. And consequently, Zadok is rewarded with sole possession of the office of high priest. So those are thumbnail sketches of the two high priests. Now let's continue back in 2 Samuel 15 in verse 25. "And the king said unto Zadok, carry back the ark of God into the city." So they'd already come out, they'd gone across the brook Kidron, and David says, "Wait a minute, guys, take the ark back." And David continues, "If I shall find favor in the eyes of Yahweh, he will bring me again and show me both it and his habitation." Well, keep in mind that David had already had the one experience at Nob where priests were massacred by Saul and Doeg because of their minimal association with David. You can imagine David's mindset now as he imagines, what if Absalom wins and David is slain? Well, then these priests and their families are going to be slain by Absalom too. And so that's playing or preying on his mind, and so he decides to send them back to Jerusalem with the ark. And in the rest of this verse, David continues his expectation of what else Yahweh might do. It's the next verse, 26. "But if he," that means Yahweh, "but if he thus say, I have no delight in thee," he's talking about David, "behold, here I am, let him do to me as seemeth good unto him." So it seems from this that David is recognizing now that all this trouble is part of God's judgment on him for the whole Bathsheba-Uriah affair. And so David is in a mode of total surrender. Not surrendering to Absalom, but he's surrendering completely to the will of God. And so that's why the title is Absalom's coup d'etat and David's surrender. You see, he's not surrendering to Absalom, is he? He's fleeing, and then he's going to let God take care of it. But he is surrendering to God, absolutely and completely. And he says to Zadok, "Look here, my friend, you and Abiathar, take that ark back to Jerusalem, because if God is merciful to me," if God is merciful, "I will come back, and I'll see you at the tabernacle, the place where God dwells. But frankly, I am deserving of no mercy." So it's quite possible, Zadok, that God is using this sequence of events to take me out of the picture. I might not make it. I just don't know. I've surrendered to him, and he will do with me whatever he wants. And then in the hope that God will restore him. And in order to do whatever's in his own power to do, David gives Zadok some further instructions. Verse 27. The king said also unto Zadok the priest, Art not thou a seer? Return into the city in peace, you and your two sons with you, Ahimaaz your son, and Jonathan the son of Abiathar. See, I will tarry in the plain of the wilderness until there come word from you to certify me. Zadok therefore and Abiathar carried the ark of God again to Jerusalem, and they tarried there. In verse 27, David seems to be making a little play on words here when he says, Are you not a seer? Zadok, as one of the two high priests, was a seer in the sense that he was given to see the divine will by means of the ephod, including the Urim and the Thummim. But David plays on the seeing part and says, If you're a seer, then go back to Jerusalem and see for me. When Absalom comes into town, observe everything that's going on and send reports back to me through your two sons. Your two respective sons, one of each of the two high priests. Verse 30, And David went up by the ascent of Mount Olivet, that means the Mount of Olives, and wept as he went up, and had his head covered, and went barefoot, and all the people that was with him covered every man his head, and they went up, weeping as they went up. This is a picture of a man in deep sorrow. And it's a perfect type and shadow of what the greater David would undergo almost exactly one millennium later in the very same location. Keep your marker here and turn to Luke 22. Luke 22. And while you're turning to Luke 22, listen to one verse. I'm quoting now from John 18:1. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, into the which he entered and his disciples. This was immediately following the Last Supper, whereupon Jesus and the disciples, it says, crossed the brook Kidron, and then Luke 22, verse 39, and he came out and went, as he was wont, to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples also followed him. And when he was at the place, he said unto them, Pray that ye enter not into temptation. Verse 41. And he was withdrawn from them about a stone's cast, and kneeled down and prayed, saying, Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. Do you see how that parallels what David had said? I might get taken out here, but if not, take that ark back and I'll see you back at the tabernacle. You know, he was saying, God, Father, do with me as you will. And this is exactly what Jesus was saying. Verse 43, And there appeared an angel unto him from heaven, strengthening him. And being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was as it were great drops of blood falling down to the ground. And when he rose up from prayer and was come to his disciples, he found them sleeping for sorrow. And he said unto them, Why sleep ye? Rise and pray, lest ye enter into temptation. And while he yet spake, behold, a multitude, and he that was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them and drew near unto Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said unto him, Judas, betrayest thou the Son of Man with a kiss? Thus Jesus fulfilled the antitype. He walked in sorrow across the brook Kidron, into the Garden of Gethsemane, which was located on the slope on the rise up to the Mount of Olives. And there in that garden, he agonized over his impending suffering. And there in the garden, he was betrayed by Judas. Judas had been one of the 12, one of his inner circle, one who had been among those closest to him for nearly 3 years. And Jesus called him friend. And this friend had betrayed him. All this is portrayed in type form in the story of David. And here now we find in Ahithophel, back in 2 Samuel, we find in Ahithophel the type for Judas, because Ahithophel was one of David's inner circle, one of his closest advisors, and he's betraying him. Verse 31. And one told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Yahweh, I pray thee, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Let's explore the Ahithophel relationship a little closer. To do so, I want you to turn forward to 2 Samuel 23, and we're going to read a passage which I quoted in my lecture from a few months ago, the one entitled David and Bathsheba. Because at that time, in connection with the matter of identifying Bathsheba's husband, Uriah the Hittite, we found the list of mighty men in 2 Samuel 23. And by reading the whole chapter, it's evident that many of these men had been the bravest men and were with David from the time he was fleeing in the wilderness from Saul. And so by the time of our current story, it had been almost perhaps 30 years or so. And let's begin reading near the end of the list, 2 Samuel 23, 35, listing the mighty men. Hezrei the Carmelite, Peari the Arbite, Igal the son of Nathan of Zobah, Bani the Gadite, Zelak the Ammonite, Naharai the Berothite, armor-bearer to Joab the son of Zeruiah, Ira an Ithrite, Gareb an Ithrite, verse 39, Uriah the Hittite, 37 in all. And now, quoting from my prior lecture, David and Bathsheba, I said, quote, "Now let me ask you a question. Doesn't it seem reasonable to assume that David not only was merely acquainted with his mighty men, but that he knew them all very well? These were 37 men who were his bravest men that had been with him for years and years by the time of the David and Bathsheba incident. And so the point is that Uriah the Hittite was not the average anonymous rank-and-file soldier who had never met the king, the commander-in-chief. As one of the 37 mighty men who'd been with David from way back, Uriah had undoubtedly been in the top ranks of David's army for many years, and David and Uriah were very well acquainted." Do you think they were friends? I should think so. End quote. Well, keep your Bible open at this place. We'll come back to it in a moment. And so with that, I'd made the case that David and Uriah had a close relationship. And then I went on to make the case that not only was David well acquainted with Uriah, but that when David gazed down from his rooftop porch into Bathsheba's garden or wherever she was bathing, that he was not looking at someone that he didn't know. And as I quote from my previous message again, something ought to now jump out at you in connection with the current context. Quote, "The next point is that Bathsheba was no stranger to David either. Look at verse 34. We started in 35, but look at 34 where it says, Eliam, the son of Ahithophel, the Gilonite. Early in our story of David and Bathsheba, we learned that Bathsheba was the daughter of Eliam. And this means that Bathsheba's father was also one of David's mighty men. End of quote. And that proved that David not only knew Uriah very well, but he had to have known Bathsheba. But what's even more important in the current context is that Bathsheba was the granddaughter of Ahithophel. And so it's now clear to see that this man, Ahithophel, even while serving all these years as one of David's closest advisors, he must have been for years suppressing his anger, his resentment, his bitterness at David for what David had done to his granddaughter and her husband. That's the motive of why he joins the conspiracy of Absalom. Because now, from Ahithophel's point of view, is payback time. He joins Absalom's rebellion. In fact, some commentators even go so far as to suggest that it was really Ahithophel's rebellion, that it was Ahithophel acting behind the scenes who saw that he could manipulate Absalom's pride and lust for power in order to extract his own revenge on David for seducing his granddaughter and killing her husband. My goodness, this sounds like a script for a Hollywood soap opera, doesn't it? Well, upon hearing of the betrayal by Ahithophel, David simply prays that Ahithophel's advice to rebellious Absalom be turned into foolishness. Now, over the course of these studies, we've seen numerous examples in the life of David how he trusts fully in the sovereignty of God, And I've tried on many occasions to drive home to my listeners that believing in the sovereignty of God and therefore in the predestination of all things does not mean that we are to sit back and do nothing. One can be fully surrendered to the will and the plan of God, and yet that doesn't mean that one should sit back and do nothing. Here's another example. David knows that God is in charge of everything, but does David sit back and have the attitude that, well, I really blew it though several years ago with the Bathsheba and Uriah thing, so I guess there's nothing more that I can do. I may as well just give up trying to be an overcomer. Is that David's attitude? Absolutely not. First, he prays, and then he takes action. He prays that God will turn the advice of Ahithophel into foolishness. And then he took action first by sending Zadok and Abiathar and their two sons back to Jerusalem with instructions to spy for him. And now, realizing there's something more he can do, David sends another spy into the presence of the enemy. Verse 32. And it came to pass that when David was come to the mount, or to the top of the mount, where he worshipped God, top of Mount of Olives, behold, Hushai the Archite came to meet him with his coat rent and earth upon his head. Now Hushai was another of David's inner circle counselors. Verse 33, unto whom David said, if thou passest on with me, then thou shalt be a burden unto me. But if thou return to the city, and say unto Absalom, I will be thy servant, O king, as I have been thy father's servant hitherto. So will I now also be thy servant. Then mayest thou for me defeat the counsel of Ahithophel. And hast thou not there with thee Zadok and Abiathar the priests? Therefore it shall be that what things soever thou shalt hear out of the king's house, thou shalt tell it to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. Behold, they have there with them their two sons, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son, and by them ye shall send unto me everything that ye can hear. So Hushai, David's friend, came into the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem. So altogether then, we now know of at least five men whom David has sent back to Jerusalem to be spies for him. Chapter 16, verse 1. And when David was a little past the top of the hill, behold, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of asses saddled, and upon them 200 loaves of bread, and 100 bunches of raisins, and 100 of summer fruits, and a bottle of wine. And the king said unto Ziba, what meanest thou by these? And Ziba said, the asses be for the king's household to ride on, and the bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine that such as be faint in the wilderness may drink. Does that name Ziba ring a bell? We did encounter him back in chapter 9. He was the servant in the house of Saul, and when David became king over all 12 tribes, he restored Saul's personal lands to Mephibosheth, who was Jonathan's son, which makes him Saul's grandson. Remember that now? And then he commanded that Ziba, who was Saul's servant, that Ziba take care of the land for Mephibosheth, because you remember Mephibosheth was lame in his feet, so he couldn't do any of the hard labor. And so Ziba and his sons and his family were taken care, or were told to take care of Mephibosheth's land for him. So David had treated both Mephibosheth and Ziba with great kindness. So now, here comes Ziba, catching up to King David with his family and his retinue as they're fleeing Jerusalem, and Ziba brings transportation and provisions of food and drink. And David wonders, Ziba, what are you doing here without Mephibosheth? Where's Mephibosheth? Verse 3, and the king said, where is thy master's son? And Ziba said unto the king, behold, he abideth at Jerusalem, for he said, today shall the house of Israel restore me the kingdom of my father. Uh-oh. Ziba is telling David that Mephibosheth has decided that Absalom's rebellion is the means by which God will restore Saul's kingdom to him. So it looks like it's a three-way play for power, doesn't it? David flees. Absalom thinks he's got a cakewalk here. And according to Ziba, Mephibosheth says, nope, this is when I'm going to be made king now. Is Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, also power-hungry, like Absalom? David might have been surprised at the ingratitude of the crippled Mephibosheth. You remember David said to Mephibosheth, look, Ziba's going to take care of all your lands for you and harvest the grain and all that. All you got to do is show up at my royal table every day and I'm going to give you food every day at the royal table. What kind of gratitude is that? It must have added further to the tremendous personal hurts that David was now enduring. 4. Then said the king to Ziba, behold, thine are all that pertained unto Mephibosheth. That means David had just given all of the property of Mephibosheth to Ziba. And Ziba said, I humbly beseech thee that I may find grace in thy sight, my lord, O king. But was Ziba telling the truth about Mephibosheth? Did Mephibosheth really think that the people would desire that the nation be turned over once again to the house of Saul, especially a cripple? The answer lies several chapters ahead, so you can read ahead if you want to learn the answer. We're going to leave the question dangling for now. There is a lesson that we can draw from Ziba's action, regardless of Mephibosheth's situation, and that lesson is that Ziba came to David and joined forces with him, came to support him and uphold him in a time of crisis and great need, because there was no assurance whatsoever that David would regain his throne. And so it took courage on the part of Ziba to cast his lot with David at this time. And so it is with each of us. We all come to times of crisis in our lives, and those who come to us and come to our aid when we are down, they come to us when we have great need. They come to support us and help us in whatever way they can. Those are the people that leave lasting impressions on us for their good works toward us, don't they? And what's the saying today? Are your friends only fair-weather friends? Or are they real friends who will stick with you through the storms of life as well? Well, not only looking at it from that point of view, but conversely, what kind of friend are you to your friends? Do you see someone who's in a crisis in your family or in the body of believers? Can you bless them with whatever assistance you can provide in their time of need? I mean, this should be second nature to us as Christians, as believers, shouldn't it? Correct that. It should be first nature if we're really serious about our faith. You agree? Verse 5, and when King David came to Bahurim, behold, thence came out a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. He came forth and cursed still as he came, cursed continuously as he came. And he cast stones at David and at all the servants of King David, and all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. And thus said Shimei when he cursed, come out, thou bloody man, and thou man of Belial. Well, picture this scene. Here is David leaving Jerusalem with a large contingent of highly trained troops surrounding him. They're walking in the bottom of a ravine, and suddenly there is Shimei walking up on the ridge, picking up stones and throwing them at David and throwing them at all of his party and kicking the dust on them, you know, from up there, hollering at them, ranting and raving, shouting vile curses upon David. And there's David, surrounded by his army rangers and Navy SEALs, all these top martial experts in Israel. I mean, this guy Shimei has to be a few gallons short of a full tank, don't you think? But even though Shimei appears to be crazy, nonetheless, notice that he tells David that the rebellion of Absalom is a judgment of God for his sins, which was the truth. Furthermore, what does Bible law say about the execution of a fornicator? How are you supposed to do that? Stone him. So do you think David might have recognized this as a token judgment of stoning, which he knew he deserved? The little stones flung by Shimei stung David, to be sure, but the stones hurled by Amnon and now by Absalom and by Ahithophel, those stones are crushing David. The metaphorical stones. So Shimei now continues his maniacal tirade against David. Verse 8. Yahweh hath returned upon thee all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose stead thou hast reigned. And Yahweh hath delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom thy son. And behold, thou art taken in thy mischief, because thou art a bloody man. David was a bloody man, wasn't he? For having ordered the death of his friend Uriah the Hittite. But it didn't take long for the stone throwing to provoke the Rangers and the Navy SEALs to ask David's permission to eliminate Shimei. And one of them says, "Hey, boss man, want me to take him out?" Incidentally, verse 9 tells us that it's Abishai who offers to take him out. Now, if you got that family tree thing again, do you remember who Abishai is? Did I put him on there? Okay, you see above David where Zeruiah was David's sister. Then you got General Joab, David's nephew. Now put another descendant of Zeruiah, Abishai. That was Joab's brother, a son of Zeruiah, David's sister. So Abishai comes out of Zeruiah. That makes him also a nephew of King David. And he's one of the mighty men there. And he says, you want me to take him out? Verse 9, then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said unto the king, "Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go, I pray thee, and take off his head." And the king said, "What have I to do with you, ye sons of Zeruiah? So let him curse, because Yahweh hath said unto him, Curse David. Who shall then say, Wherefore hast thou done so?" Do you see how David recognizes the hand of God in this event, the sovereignty of God? Verse 11, and David said to Abishai and to all his servants, "Behold, my son," meaning Absalom, "which came forth of my bowels, seeketh my life. How much more now may this Benjamite do? Let him alone and let him curse, for Yahweh hath bidden him. It may be that Yahweh will look on mine affliction, and that Yahweh will requite me good for his cursing this day." And as David and his men went by the way, Shimei went along on the hill's side over against him, and cursed as he went, and threw stones at him, and cast dust. And the king and all the people that were with him became weary, and refreshed themselves there. Let's look at this Shimei incident as it can apply to us today. When you are confronted with an enemy of whatever sort, internal, external, and the enemy appears crazy, goes off on maniacal tirades against you, you have two possible reactions, two choices. You can use your power, your might, military force or physical brute force or whatever, wipe out your enemy. Like David had that choice. Or you can, number two, hear the voice of God through your enemy. Our willingness to listen to our critics, even hostile critics who have only ill intent towards us, that may be the only way that God's truth can be received on a given matter. So when you're confronted by your Shimeis, you have a choice. Will you crush him in any way you can so as to avoid the pain? Or will you consider that just maybe God is speaking to you through your Shimei? Well, finally, David and his band of not-so-merry men and their families have passed beyond Shimei, and they are now in the wilderness again. David's in the wilderness? Oh, let's see. Did we think that we have only one wilderness experience in this life? You know, David was out there fleeing Saul in the wilderness, and then he comes to the throne and everything's wonderful. Oh, until some decades later, and it's during his reign as king, he has to flee into the wilderness again. So don't be surprised, my friends, my fellow overcomer candidates, if you should find yourself in the wilderness again, of one sort or another. But they finally come to a place of rest for the time being, and we're not going to read any more text today. But before I close, or in closing, I want to go back and revisit a couple of verses. During this entire course of lectures on Saul and David, one of our primary purposes has been to point out the character qualities of these men, which show us, on the one hand, that if we emulate Saul, we will be non-overcomers. We will not be overcomers. We may believe in Jesus, like Saul believed in God. We may go to church. We may even support the work of God with our money. But if we do all of that and our heart is soaked in bitterness and resentment and jealousy and unforgiveness and so on, then we're going to be part of the weak company, the non-overcomer class. On the other hand, if we emulate and continually strive to emulate the plethora of virtues which were exhibited for the most part in the life of David, the virtues of forgiveness of one's enemies, of love instead of hatred, of joy instead of jealousies over another's achievements, of kindness instead of little digs at one another, and on and on. If our heart is practiced with these beautiful fruits of the Spirit, then we stand, in my view, a good chance of being classed among the overcomers. As I say, this has been the major theme of all these studies. But now let me throw you a curve. As Christians practicing to be overcomers, many of you have shared with me how difficult it is to actually practice and exhibit these fruits on a daily basis, especially that one about truly forgiving those who hate you and those who despitefully use you, especially when they're in your own family or close acquaintances. Can anybody say amen? It is difficult. As I've said before, that's why they call it overcoming. But now let me ask you to consider something that is perhaps even more difficult. And I want to return to one of what I consider to be the key passages in today's lecture, 2 Samuel 15, verse 25 and 6. 25 and 6. And the king said unto Zadok, carry back the ark of God into the city. If I shall find favor in the eyes of Yahweh, he will bring me back again and show me both it and his habitation. But if he say thus, I have no delight in thee, behold, here am I, let him do to me as seemeth good unto him. You see, David had passed the overcomer test with Saul. He had opportunity to kill Saul on two occasions, but he chose to forgive that tortured soul and to let God either keep Saul or remove him from that position of authority. David would not touch the Lord's anointed. But as we have seen previously, David subsequently fell hard in the matter of Bathsheba and Uriah. And now he recognizes that all of these troubles is part of the judgment which Nathan the prophet had told him would come upon him. And so at this juncture, David now gives us another picture of the attitude of one who is truly an overcomer. It's the attitude that, Father, I am a sinner who does not deserve your mercy. But nevertheless, I throw myself on your mercy, and if you should choose to restore me to the throne, I will praise you. But if not, I will praise you even if you discard me from that position of authority. You see, the throne, the position of authority, is what overcomers are going to be given in the first resurrection, aren't they? Revelation 5:10, we shall reign on the earth. Now, I do not want to see a show of hands here because I don't want to embarrass anybody, but I know that probably every adult here can admit that he or she also has sinned badly enough somewhere along the line, may not have been the same sins as David, but sinned badly enough that he or she figures that they just disqualified themselves from ever being an overcomer. And that recognition by all of us puts us all in the same class as David here, doesn't it? In the same situation. And so can we say to our Father that although we might strive with all of our might for the rest of our lives to be an overcomer, that after all that striving, are we willing to be classed with the non-overcomers? Can we be so surrendered to Father's plan that we can joyfully acknowledge His sovereignty if He should say, as David puts the words in God's mouth, if God should say to you, I have no delight in thee? Can we accept with all humility that maybe, just maybe, we might end up in the non-overcomer class after all? And you know, that wouldn't be all bad. Because when that first resurrection happens and those dead overcomers join the live overcomers, even the wheat company is going to have their socks blessed off. You know, it's going to be better than we have it now. You will be blessed. But you will, are you ready to say, Father, even if you choose not to have me as one of your overcomers, I will bless you and praise your name? If we are truly overcomer candidates, then somewhere along our line of spiritual growth, I think we need to be able to say that. Turn to Romans 9, because we have a New Testament example of something very similar and even going a step further than that. Romans chapter 9, verse 1. Listen to the Apostle Paul's words and see if you don't agree. Romans 9, 1. I say the truth in Christ, I lie not, my conscience also bearing me witness in the Holy Ghost, that I have great heaviness and continual sorrow in my heart. Why? 3. For I could wish that myself were accursed from Christ for my brethren, my kinsmen according to the flesh, who are Israelites and so forth. Did you hear that? Do you understand what Paul is saying? He is so desirous of his brother Israelites coming to Christ that he says, I could trade my own salvation so that they could be saved. He was not just demoting himself to the non-overcomer class of believers here. He was willing to be placed with the heathen and suffer through the lake of fire for the sake of his brethren. Now that is an attitude of an overcomer. We're not asking you to go that far. Paul did. But can we do what David did? Can we surrender to the Father like David did so that we can be willing to not be rewarded with the high crown if that is Father's design? I want to leave you with that to ponder, because that will take some honest soul searching before I think any of us can truly say amen to that. But I'm going to say amen on the message right now. So that'll conclude the message. Thank you.